shall inherit the earth.
Hello, you are listening to Newsarama Radio. I'm Lucas.
I'm Jill.
I'm Albert.
And we are here to talk to you today about quite a bit of stuff, so stick around. Also, stick around for a special extra song in the middle of the show once again. This time not by our friend MC Lars, who provided our intro music. Thanks again, Lars. So, Young Justice, new TV show. DC and Warner's did a little bit of promoting of it over at San Diego. Then they kind of didn't talk about it much, too much at New York Comic Con. And they did this weird random preview of it where they showed an hour, basically the first two episodes together, and then never showed it again.
No repeats, no nothing, nothing in the DVR. I remember looking through saying, oh, when's the next episode going to be on? Oh, none.
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
And it's not going to be on again until January, right?
Yeah, I think the end of January is when the show's actually premiering. End of January, early. Probably could have researched that before we started recording.
It's whatever, 2011 somewhere.
Yeah, sometime
still,
next year.
The fact is, they premiered
it all seems
it now.
So far off now, so yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really bizarre. I know this was kind of like a build buzz thing, but who is it really for? If they do something, a special preview like this, who is that for? Because if you do it and you say it's for the kids are just going to be upset that they can't watch another episode the next week. And then they're going to forget about it by the time the show actually starts. You're going to have to re-educate them that this show is coming, right?
I would think so. And plus, they showed it over, it was Thanksgiving weekend, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, sure, people are home, but they're with their families. So are they necessarily sitting down to watch this brand new animated series?
Exactly, because a lot of the times when they do have like a one-off premiere and then the show isn't on again, it's like on some type of auspicious date that a lot of people are going to be able to see it. Like Glee premiered, in May 2009, like months before another episode aired, but it was immediately after the American Idol season finale. So it was like a prime targeted demographic, as opposed to just putting a cartoon show on Cartoon Network on holiday weekend, which is a very, you would think, unlikely time that people would see it.
Right, and then they put Glee up on iTunes, and they put it up on Hulu, like, virtually the next day. And left it up there, even though the season wasn't properly starting. So, strange move, but did either of you guys catch the...
I did, yeah. I missed the first, like, 10, 15 minutes, but caught the most of it. It was good, you know? It's DC animation, and they're always quality. But, you know, it's the whole thing. It was funny. My brother was watching it with me, and he was saying things about, you know, who was who. And I was trying to explain to him about who this, you know, new Aqualad was and which Robin it was. And then I was completely wrong about that because it's on Earth 16. So, yeah.
Yeah, the dealing with which Robins it was and stuff like that was certainly interesting. Because it's Dick Grayson, but he looks
like Tim Drake,
and then he kind of acts like a mixture of the two of them. He's got Tim's computer smarts, and for those not in the know, Tim Drake is the third Robin. Dick Grayson's the first one. In between is Jason Todd, who's the redheaded stepchild nobody likes to talk about.
Except he also was a brunette, though.
He's actually a redhead.
Actually a redhead, yeah.
His natural hair color is red. So maybe you should go read a comic book.
You guys are bigger DC fans than me. I think I knew that, like deep down. Now that you said that, it made sense. But.
And I'm a redhead, so I had to know.
Yeah, yeah. So he, as you guys can all clearly see over the radio waves.
Well, take a look me up.
There are, in fact, pictures of Jill Pantozzi on the internet, and that's all I will say about that.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, so that was a little maybe slightly confusing for longtime DC fans until they give you the premise they tell you, the producers have been trumpeting the fact, this is an alternate Earth.
Because everyone is so goddamn confused.
This is Earth 38 or whatever the heck.
Yeah, I mean, they had a Zatara come in there with the Justice League, which I was surprised
Zatara
about.
Was a founding member of the Justice League, of course.
Well, yeah, but now that...
On Earth 38.
Yeah. It's just, I don't know. And then, of course, you have the whole fact that there was only males for the majority of the episode. Which, I'm the female, so obviously I'm going to bring that up, right?
Well, what did you think about that? Is that something that, I mean, it seemed like it was somewhat organic the way the story was told.
Right, right.
Because it came from these three who were probably the longest timed sidekicks.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of made sense in that way, as far as a storytelling standpoint, starting with three or four particular ones. They really wanted to introduce the new Aqualad because he's the big new character to the show. He's getting the big push in Brightest Day right now in the comic books. So while it is somewhat auspicious, the comic book started with just guys too.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the thing is that they're already saying, well, this is not, you know, the primary Earth, you know, so we can do this, this, and this because it's different. So they basically could have told any story they wanted to, you know. They could have included one of the females from the get-go. You know, they chose not to for whatever reason and had Miss Martian just come in at the end. And when she came in, I was like, oh, I want to see you do stuff. Oh, I'm not going to be able to until a couple months down the road. Great.
But
voiced by Danica McKellar, though.
Yes. Yes. Which is awesome.
Former Winnie Cooper, current math expert.
With her own math theorem named after her.
Guest star on Big Bang Theory.
And general super hottie. So Young Justice overall, I mean, the premiere was exciting. I want to see more of the show. And it was a really strange decision to do a preview like this. But hopefully it got some people's buzzing. And hopefully people don't all just go out and download it through nefarious means since they can't see it any other way.
They really should have it up somewhere. That's just ridiculous.
Speaking of ridiculous, the Spider-Man musical had its first preview night last weekend.
Nice segue.
This show is going to be a challenge. It's super, super expensive. They're going to have to sell out for like 900 years or something in order to make up the money. And it had its growing pains for sure. Albert, you looked into this quite a bit. What did you find out about the premiere?
I found out a lot about it. It's basically, it was, I mean, I don't know exactly the standard for previews. I mean, it's not fair to totally judge it because it wasn't the official opening, but I guess four times they had to stop the show in the first act and five times total. And there were people walking out. There were people yelling out in the audience saying it was basically a dress rehearsal. And the reviews, I mean, some of the reviews try to be fair, like, well, if they get their act together, it could possibly be great. But it seems like that might require a lot of work between now and January when the show officially debuts. To me, the weirdest thing, though, is some of the characters that are included in it. Like the fact that Swarm is part of the Sinister Six in this musical, which, you know, not to get too obscure, but Swarm is probably one of the most obscure Marvel villains there is. And also, you would think, like, one of the hardest to properly capture in a Broadway musical live theater setting, given that he's basically just a man comprised of bees.
Well,
and maybe that's why it's so expensive. Maybe, it's all the swarm
maybe they have live bees.
Yes.
Yeah, like, you know, Bono.
Swarming. Yeah,
they were, that's not where the money went. Or like the web spinning effects, it was all in the Swarm budget, in which case I guess we'll see if that proves to be a wise decision or not.
And coming in 2011, they'll have the Swarm branded beehives that kids can get and start beekeeping from a young age.
Oh god.
And we'll have the Swarm ringtones, which is just a bunch of buzzing.
Let's talk about the people hanging over the audience. How horrible is that? I mean, okay, granted. All right, it's previews. I know there are some issues, but with such a high-profile show, this is Spider-Man, okay? Everybody in the world, you know, knows who Spider-Man is. They're going to want to come and see this show. If you have the preview show, it better be damn perfect.
And it is straight. I mean, people saying it's a dress rehearsal, well... That is actually kind of what a preview is. That's what the whole preview month is. It's essentially dress rehearsals. They allow for things to go wrong. They allow for stoppages if they have to. That's the Broadway culture. Typically in the past, they would actively prevent press from attending preview shows, and tickets would be pretty heavily discounted. Here people were paying $150 to see this show, and it, you know, a 2-hour show dragged on for 3.5 hours, and there were literally actors hanging over the heads of people in the audience.
Trying to think of something to say, redoing songs, whatever they could do.
I really do wish that I could see the stagehands were actually standing at the edge of the stage, jumping up and down, trying to grab the foot of an actor.
Yeah.
So I think that people still got their money's worth, because that sounds damned entertaining to me.
Yeah, in a roundabout way.
Yeah, it was entertainment one way or another.
I'm you know, cautiously hopeful. I don't want this thing to fail. I like you too, who did the music for the show, and Julie Tamer, not Tambor. No relation to Jeffrey Tambor. Sorry, that was a... We like telling inside jokes where you can't even see us laughing here on the radio. But yeah, Julie Tamer, of course, is of hearty Broadway stock as well with her.
The thing you have to think of is this isn't going to happen forever. You know, in a year down the road, they're not still going to have people getting stuck over the audience. It's going to get fixed. You know, but are people going to... still want to go to the show after hearing these things? Because I heard all these types of stories, but I didn't actually hear anyone tell how good the actual story itself was.
And that sure seems to have been left out of a lot of the initial reports. It was all about the farcical goings-on and not about how was the story? How were the songs? Were the performers any good? All I heard was that Green Goblin has a Southern accent. That was the only performance-based thing I've read about it so far. So we'll see. Hopefully Spider-Man turn off the dark, doesn't turn off the lights too soon.
Well, if things turn around and it becomes a success, much will that mean a wave of comic-based musicals? Like, sooner we're going to maybe see a Namor musical in 2017?
Oh, God.
Yes.
Help us.
Actually, Aquaman would lend himself much better to a musical.
You know who I think need a musical? The Secret Six.
The Secret Six. Yeah. A musical with book by Gail Simone.
Exactly. That is screwed up family unit, as it were. Come on.
That would be interesting, yes. So, Mark Miller has a...
Swarm would no longer be the most obscure character in a Broadway musical.
This is true. So what's Mark Miller's big news, his latest news that he's shouting from the rooftops?
The Kapow Comic-Con, of course.
Kapow!
Thank God it's not called Mark Millar-Con. God.
Well, yes, because that would be odd for him to mispronounce his last name like that, for one.
Whatever.
yeah, so Kapow. Thoughts?
Well, I mean, good for them over there, because they don't have too many big conventions, right?
I feel like, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I feel like Andy Diggle, Jock, and... Paul Cornell? Yeah, Paul Cornell, thank you, are tweeting about being at a different convention like every other weekend.
Right, but how big are they? I mean, I don't know. But, I mean, Mark Miller is comparing this to San Diego for the UK, you know, which, you know, maybe they need something like that for not only people that are in the UK, but Europe itself, you know, to have a big show.
And the man's certainly a promoter, so it's already gotten more attention here in America than any UK convention that I can think of.
That's true. That's very true. I think it's overall it's good. I mean, any showing of industry strength or growth is always a good thing, and maybe this will help. Oddly, the American comics industry in Europe, because it sounds like this is going to be a largely American Comic Con. I could have done without the kapow. I mean, it's like every annoying headline that you see in mainstream press where people do biff, bam, pow.
What would you call it?
I don't know. What? Call it MillerCon. Why not?
No.
Why not? He's got Miller World.
God.
He likes being the face of his own stuff. So why not just be the face of your own stuff? I don't know. I think there could have been something a little bit better.
I'm wondering how it's going to be run. You know, how many people does he have putting it together for him? You know, because, I mean, San Diego and New York, you know, these are companies themselves that put these shows together. So,
right.
Well, they're going to have a break at 3 for tea time. Sorry, I don't know. I was debating like for a good couple seconds whether or not that was worth saying.
No, that was perfect. Don't ever second guess yourself again, Albert. It was beautiful. Yeah, I'm interested to see how much industry support it winds up getting, because obviously that's going to wind up being key. The guy's obviously a big Marvel guy, but he's always talking about how much he loves DC too. So, and he's got, I think, generally speaking, is pretty well liked in the comic book industry. I mean, it seems like people, other creators and whatnot, have decent opinions of him and whatnot. So we'll see.
And don't forget about Hollywood. Hollywood loves him.
Hollywood loves him. Hollywood right now is making like 18 Mark Miller movies, and he's writing some and producing some and probably starring in some. Mark Miller in Miller World, the Mark Miller story, produced by Mark Miller.
Score by Mark Miller.
Yes. Starring Mark Miller as Mark Miller. Mark Miller as Brian Michael Bendis. Mark Miller as Joe Quesada. coming soon to a theater.
Scary thought.
So DC Comics announced over the last couple of days some further restructuring and shuffling and promotions and
First of all, congratulations to everyone.
Absolutely, congratulations to everybody. Now, can we be done with the restructuring?
I don't know how many more new positions they can create. There's going to be no positions left. They keep, you know, promoting everybody. There's going to be nothing left.
No one's going to be anybody's boss anymore.
Right.
It's going to be chaos. It's interesting, too. DC, you know, put out these press releases about the promotions and then didn't mention, like, 90% of the staff that got promotions. So congratulations to all the new associate editors. A bunch of assistants got promoted to associate. A couple of associates got promoted to editor, I think, too. Just check the credits listings of your recent DC Comics, and you'll see all those. I'm a little perplexed as to why they're putting out on, like, the source and whatnot, press releases about background new VPs being created and this and that. Is that something that the general comic book fan that they're trying to reach with the source really...
That's interesting, because I was just thinking, well, for us, it matters because we're writing about it. But, yeah, no, for just your everyday average comic reader, I don't think it really does make much difference, you know, unless you're a really hardcore DC fan who knows these people, you know?
Right. Yeah, I think that was a slightly strange decision. But, you know, it's not to take away at all from these people's great news. And hopefully this is the last of this for a while, and we can start focusing on the way that they're going to grow the comics industry. And I guess if that's possible, I mean, I think that's really the bigger question here. Obviously, Time Warner is saying, hey, look, we still believe in our publishing arm. We're promoting people. We're creating some new positions. Is that just a show of faith, or do they know something we don't know?
I'm sure they know a lot that we don't know.
Albert, does the comic industry have a way to grow right now?
Sure. Absolutely. I'm sure it does. But the thing that stuck out to me about the news is that, you know, for a long time, they didn't have an editor-in-chief position. Mm-hmm. But then they would have executive editors. And then Bob Harris became editor-in-chief. So there was an executive editor for, like, I guess a couple months. But now Eddie Braganza is executive editor. It seems like there's, like, a lot of titles being thrown around that all sound...
Well, and it's interesting because...
They also have two publishers. It just seems like there's a lot of...
That's what I'm saying. A lot of higher-ups. Yeah. You know?
Right. And it sounds like...
John's position, you know, as chief creative officer, it just seems like...
It sounds like executive editor... Executive editor even means a different thing now than it did a few months ago or a year ago. When Dan DiDio was executive editor, he was acting as kind of the editor-in-chief. And now the press release was actually pointed out that Eddie Braganza is executive editor, but he's serving alongside senior group editors Matt Idelson and Mike Martz. Rather than above, as Dan DiDio clearly was when he was executive editor. So it's an interesting, it's clearly a true example of restructuring. And like you said, it's interesting to see how these different titles are clearly taking on new meanings, and congrats to all. With that, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to go get some more drinks and, you know, hang out.
Not that we're drinking.
You are going...
V8 drinks.
Right, right.
Something red.
Yeah. V8, that's the ticket. It's blood. It's blood. We're all vampires, so we need to go take a blood break. And you are going to listen to Kirby Crackle's Ring Capacity.
Woo!
This is an awesome Green Lantern song, and you're going to love it, or else. So... Listen to Kirby Crackle serenade you, and Newsarama Radio will be right back.
I've yet to find my place. I'm guarding 2814. I don't know why it's chosen me. From the corner of my eye, I catch a glimpse of evil light. Fear tries to swallow me.
Like my father said,
drink.
was Kirby Crackle. You were just listening to one of my favorites on Newsarama Radio. I'm Jill, and I'm here with Lucas and Albert, and we're going to talk about the big story, The Walking Dead. Of course, Frank Darabont, the news came out this week on Deadline that basically he was firing the entire writing staff because he thinks he can do it all himself. No, not really. He's actually going to be hiring a few freelancers instead.
How do you really feel about this? Man.
Actually, I love Frank Darabont, and I've loved The Walking Dead so far. But I just think it's a very odd move. What about you guys?
Tackling the news bit here first, what people skipped over in the Deadline announcement was the actual division of labor for these first six episodes, this first season. Very British of them to do a six-episode first season.
Right.
The first six episodes, Darabont wrote two on his own.
Kirkman wrote one.
Which he still said was a collaborative thing.
And then, yeah, right, also kind of with Darabont. And with some help from the staff writers, I guess. And then they had a freelance writer that did an episode. The staff writers only solely wrote one episode out of six. And then, according to Deadline, Darabont took that script that they gave, and he did some rewrites before he actually shot it. So, this isn't unheard of. This is done, it's almost commonplace on a lot of British shows where you basically have a head writer and that's it. And then you get everything else from the proverbial zeitgeist. You have your freelancers. That's what's being done with the next season of Torchwood, The New World, and it was done quite a bit with Caprica. They had a lot of freelance writers. Big name freelance writers, but freelance writers nonetheless. Right.
But it's not so commonplace in the U.S. I think that's why it's such a big deal.
Right.
And the Deadline report implied that it was so not commonplace that it might actually raise the attention of the Writers Guild of America.
Yeah.
Look into that somehow.
But what can they... I mean...
I don't know. I guess it's... I don't know how the Writers Guild works as far as freelance versus a full-time paid position. Maybe they favor, you know, the full-time.
Well, I would imagine that any guild or group like that is going to favor full-time work with benefits and everything over that. But, I mean... This seems like a pretty logical progression from the way that he's currently running the show. It doesn't seem like that gigantic of a move, aside from the fact that there are people that are losing full-time jobs. Will some of them or one of them or any of them be asked to contribute to season two? Possibly. Now, who knows if any of them would really want to.
Right, after this. It's just, I don't know. I mean, do you want, if I was Frank Darabont, would I want to shoulder that much? I mean, it's going to be 13 episodes now. It's not going to be six.
Right.
You know, it's a lot of work.
Kirkman said he wants to write another one.
Right. And I'm sure, yeah. Oh, no. I mean, I think they still said that Kirkman was going to be involved in some way.
He's still executive producer and whatnot. So.
Yeah. But, like, how much work do you want? You're already, you know, doing so much for the show as it is. I don't know. I think having that collaborative kind of environment helps, you know, even if somebody, the main person is writing it, fine, but you have the input from everybody else.
Yeah, well, ultimately, it's hard to say, I guess, how big of a news story that really is, because obviously the headline by itself, that the entire staff of a show that seems to be successful both critically and ratings-wise was fired, is like, whoa, why would they do that? That's insane. But then, as you were talking about, Lucas, when you read more into it, you find out that the actual input of the writing staff seems to be somewhat negligible in the first season, then you kind of think, well, you know, maybe, you know, we don't really know how big of a deal it is, I guess, until the second season starts and you see if it's, you know, noticeably different.
Right. I think ultimately this is going to be a relative non-story if, like you said, if the quality of the show stays the same, the average viewer isn't going to care.
Right. The only downfall is the new season isn't going to start until the fall.
Right.
So we have a long time to wait to see whether this is good or bad or not.
I would liken this to Call of Duty. Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 came out.
Lucas always falling back on the video games.
In case
you don't know us.
This is pretty relevant.
Okay,
Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 came out last year, developed by the developer Infinity Ward, who came up with the Call of Duty series. And it broke entertainment records. It made more money on day one and made more money in 5 days than any other piece of entertainment, movie, TV, music, or video game, had ever done. Ever. Then something went down between Activision and the founders of Infinity Ward, where apparently Infinity Ward was not being paid the original agreed-upon royalties for the game, and the two guys that founded Infinity Ward quit very publicly. It was all over all the game news sites, and they made a big, big deal out of it, and they brought a lot of people from the studio with them. They've created a new studio. They're working on a couple of new games right now, which everybody's pretty excited to see. And Call of Duty, meanwhile, went as it was planned to for 2011 over to Treyarch, who's been the alternate year Call of Duty developer, another fully owned Activision developer. Treyarch put out Call of Duty Black Ops, and what did it do? It broke every entertainment record in history, including last year's Modern Warfare 2-1. Nobody gave a damn that Infinity Ward had a falling out with Activision. Nobody cared that the creators of the series no longer support it. They went out and they bought the game.
Right.
And they enjoyed it, and it's gotten good reviews, and it broke every entertainment record ever. So I really think this is going to be one of those cases where, not to sound pompous or well, anti-pompous, I guess, but we're making ourselves out to be more important than we are in our niche industry of this entertainment reporting. And the record audiences that are watching this show right now are not even going to hear about this, let alone care.
Yeah. As long as it's good next fall, I'm assuming October, because that would be cool again. But yeah, next fall, as long as it breaks records on its premiere episode of season 2, no one's going to care after that.
So jumping into the show a little bit, the show, we're 5 episodes in now to the 6 episode season, and it has derivated quite a bit.
Yeah.
From the comic book series. Both of you are familiar with the comic?
Yes, although the early issues, I mean, I don't remember very well. I don't remember stuff that happened in comic books like a year ago very well, as we heard earlier.
I don't remember last week.
So I won't be too great on the details, but
right.
Well, I'm sure.
Well,
we know the general stuff in the show that was not in the comic. We'll put it that way instead of, you know, vice versa.
Right, right. I actually just recently reread the entire series, so I'm nice and up to date. It's called prep work, Albert. Albert, you were supposed to read 80 issues of this comic book for this 1 half-hour segment. I don't know what's wrong with you.
Feel ashamed.
You should. Yeah, it has stepped to the side quite a bit. There's new characters that are in the show that didn't exist in the comic book. Quite a few at the very beginning here. There have been new locations. There have been other characters that they've interacted with. And in fact, the Kirkman-written episode, the 4th episode of the season, was the first one that really stepped away from the comic quite a bit. It introduced a whole new group Without getting into too much spoiling, is it a good thing? Is it a good thing from a fan perspective, and is it an essential thing for a TV show?
I was going to say, I don't know if it's whether it's good or bad for fans, but for a TV show, I think it has to, you know, because for hardcore fans of the comic, if you're just going to replay the entire comic series, it's going to be boring. You're going to know what's going to happen, you know. You don't want that for a TV show. You want to keep people coming back, you know, and then for the people that don't read the comic, it doesn't really matter because they don't know these characters anyway, so you have to develop them on their own and get viewers to attach to them in some way. And I'll compare it to something like True Blood, which is a hugely popular, you know, book series. They've had to diverge.
Sick Stackhouse novels.
They've had to diverge from the novels, you know, and that's just the way it is, you know. I mean, obviously, things will come in eventually that fans are you know, very excited about. But, you know, you have to make it a TV show. It's not a comic book. We have to remember that, you know.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure why even, like, fans would have the expectation that it would be, you know, too strictly tied to the comic books. Maybe just because Robert Kirkman is heavily involved.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it.
But, you know, with TV shows, I mean, you always expect there to be a level or, and sometimes, a huge level of changes between the comic books and the shows. And I think this is actually probably the most faithful TV version of a comic book, if you think about it, because the rest were either kind of sort of entirely new creations inspired by comic books like Smallville, or sort of, you know, kind of pastiche things like the 70s Hulk TV show or Wonder Woman that were clearly not based on any specific comics, just kind of more the general concept of the characters. And I mean, I don't really know what else is there that would be close to the Walking Dead show in terms of resembling the source material. I mean, I never saw the Witchblade show, but I'm pretty sure that wasn't a good candidate for that either. So.
Probably not. Let's go ahead and assume no. Birds of Prey sure as hell wasn't.
Oh, God.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, comparatively, God. Yeah.
You have no idea how excited I was when that show was first coming on. I'm like, yes, Birds of Prey TV show. This is going to be awesome. Oh, okay, Harley Quinn's kind of old. That's all right. They could do what they want, you know? And then it was just so bad.
Yeah.
And also, at this point, like, I almost forget that Birds of Prey was on TV. Like, I sort of think of it as maybe just something that was, like, developed as a pilot and never aired. Like, it seems weird. Like, doesn't it seem to, like, jive with reality that that show is actually, like, on TV for several weeks?
I think that's the majority of the public, yeah. Actually. They could totally make another Birds of Prey show and make it, like,
they should.
Good.
Why
you know?
The hell
like,
not?
The way I think of it, like, if they had done it similar to how Alias was or something like that, where, you know, instead of one, you know, girl that was, you know, out there fighting crime, you have three, you know. I don't know. It was so wasted.
Well, they've got, what's her name, Elena Huffman, as Black Canary on Smallville, mm-hmm. So they could always backdoor her into it or something like that. But
right.
I think she's on a different show now, too.
Didn't Aunt Becky from Full House play Black Canary in the Birds of Prey show? Like, the actual, like, the character that was supposed to be Black Canary was, like, someone else, but she was, like, her mother, who was basically, like, the Black Canary from the comics.
I think you're right, yeah. I think she was on it, and so was the blonde chick from Jericho.
What a cast.
Yeah, I really love that Albert and I are both sitting in front of a computer right now, and neither of us are bothering to pull this up on IMDb.
Well, I don't want that the typing noise on Gary on
the No one cares that much.
Special demeanor here.
That was pretty annoying last time, so...
Back to The Walking Dead.
No. Hold on. Walking Dead's on pause right now. No. We're talking about the awesomeness of Birds of Prey. Welcome to the Birds of Prey TV Appreciation Podcast.
Well, I have
that's probably the subject of every episode, I think. Yeah.
I have to say, the best part...
Mia Sara was Harley Quinn.
That's exactly what I was going to say, Mia Sara. And when I found that out, that made me even more excited. For those of you who don't know, Mia Sara was the girl from Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Yes.
And the lead in the, I guess I would say cult classic, because not everyone likes it, but Legend, with Tom Cruise and Tim Curry.
Who can't love Tom Cruise in tights and Tim Curry with devil horns?
I'm just saying. I'm putting it out there. But yeah, she's awesome. So I was very interested to see where they
went
with her.
Some may say the most true-to-life role that Tom Cruise has ever played.
But yeah, I wanted to see so much more. And it just, you know, it didn't live up to expectations.
Mark Hamill was the Joker on it, though.
Yeah.
Or the voice of the Joker.
The voice, yeah. Yeah,
Roger Stoneburner. Good old famous Roger Stoneburner. He was the actual face of
one
the
of his best.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but was Alfred in it? And was
Alfred
the
was
one
in
that
it.
Was in the Batman films for four movies?
It was Ian Abercrombie, who is the Emperor. He's Darth Sidious, Emperor Palpatine. Ian Abercrombie on Star Wars, The Clone Wars. Ian Abercrombie has been in a lot of stuff. He did, in fact, play...
He is an old dude.
He played Old Man on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So, he's got that on his resume. I don't see him in any Batman movies.
Okay, then I must be thinking...
He was on the Flash TV series. Another classic.
Yeah, John Wesley Shipp. That's Barry Allen. Dawson's father.
I was just going to say, Dawson's father.
Okay, can I point out that you knew that off the top of your head?
I love that he said it before I did. Just
but you didn't know that Jason Todd was a redhead, and that
I do know that. I just forgot.
7 months ago.
Sure.
It was like a year ago. That comic's had a lot of waves.
Oh, man. Ian Abercrombie was in the original Battlestar Galactica. We have... Totally.
I love
totally
how all that stuff comes together eventually.
I could do an IMDb podcast, I think, where you just sit there and surf IMDb and just see where it takes you.
6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
6 degrees of Dina Meyer as Barbara Gordon. Ashley Scott as Helena Kyle.
So, that's right, because it was Batman and Catwoman's daughter.
Right. Which is different. Well, that's Earth 2, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm just trying to pretend like I know about some comics.
No, Earth 2 Huntress was Helena Kyle.
He knew something, Lucas.
Good job.
Just congratulate him.
Aw. We're so proud of you, Albert. So, we digress. Hopefully you just skipped the last, 8 minutes of this show.
You're like, what? They're talking about Birds of Prey, the TV show? Screw that.
Some of the more controversial changes for The Walking Dead. One, so far the only main African-American character on the show is T-Dog. Fans of the comic will know that there's a primary African-American character introduced early on who is not named T-Dog but does have a T name, so people are confused, curious, concerned that this is that character. I don't know. I think T-Dog started off worse than he's gotten. They've developed the character quickly, which was essential. I think they definitely presented him initially, and any character that you're calling on screen on a regular basis, T-Dog, is going to come off as a bit of a stereotype. It just seems like a weird choice. It's one of the few things that I had an issue with in the first couple episodes. I don't know. What do you guys think about T-Dog? Anyone? T-Dog?
Yeah, he's all right.
What do you think of him as I mean, if he's just a new character,
right?
Do you think Do you think he's better as just a new character or as a replacement?
I think it's probably best to think of him just as a new character.
Yeah, new character.
Rather than trying to frustrate yourself with why certain things don't match up with how they maybe should be.
Some of the other, obviously the two brothers are both new, the Dixon brothers.
Mm-hmm. Which I think is a very good addition.
Yeah, that's a cool addition for sure.
I think it is too, and this is going to sound extremely strange no matter how I say this out loud, but the fact that they are racist pricks is actually really, really interesting.
Well, yeah, obviously. It makes for a good conflict on the show.
It makes for good conflict on the show, and it's appropriate to a show that, I mean, not to give any kind of stereotype, but to have two guys that happened to have some weapons and happened to have some survival skills in the South also happen to be a bit racist is not far off from certain stereotypes, and that was not represented at all. There's no character like that at all in the comic. I'm really happy with the way that the show has shown a little bit more of a picture of the world, where it's not just the plucky group of survivors.
Mm-hmm.
In the comic book, and hopefully eventually in the show, they wind up at a prison for an extended time. And there, of course, they run into some inmates, and a couple of the inmates are less likable scamps than the others. But otherwise, the comic has underserved that quite a bit, and that's something I really like about the TV show. Hmm. Is that something you've noticed at all, Albert?
Yeah, I agree with that. I definitely think it seems like... I guess maybe that's also just sort of a side effect of adapting things for TV. Maybe they just figured they needed to kind of broaden that world a little bit more in ways that maybe TV audiences would be more easy to accept and without things that comic book readers could kind of overlook because based on, you know, sort of the nature of the genre. But one thing I've noticed about the show, I don't know if you guys have noticed it, is even though I think most people like it a lot and... You know, it's definitely gotten good reviews and everything. There also seems to already, even though the six episode season's not over yet, to be like a bit of a backlash going with people, not just complaining about not being authentic to the comics, but also complaining a lot about, you know, sort of like the logic of how the zombies, you know, what they can and can't do, and, you know, little kind of nitpicky plot things. Like, I've noticed it more with The Walking Dead than a lot of TV shows. I don't know if it's just because it's, you know, based on a comic and that kind of brings out that type of nitpicky viewership, or I don't know, have you guys noticed that?
Are you seeing that, like, from comic book fans in particular on comic book websites?
Yeah, mainly comic book fans, but also on some more general websites like, you know, the blog Warming Glow, which is a pretty funny TV blog. Like, the guy who writes there is, you know, he's generally likes the show, but he was taking issue with some of the, he says, clunky dialogue and huge plot holes. I have it in front of me now. Hmm. And it seems like, it's not, I mean, at first I was, you know, it seemed very across the board beloved, and now it seems like it's kind of, in almost in record time, like, purged the backlash from fans.
Huh. Well, I haven't really heard the nitpicky stuff, but I did hear a couple people last week, and I'm not going to, you know, do spoiler stuff, but people start saying, oh, this show better not turn into Lost. And it took me a couple minutes to think about what they were actually talking about. And it was one of the new things that you know, was not in the comic. And I thought, why would you think it's going in that direction? This is just another, you know, interesting plot device that they've decided to build into the series, you know? whether they like it or not is, you know, another story, but I think that, like we said before, it's just one of those things that has to happen, you know, for the story to evolve.
Hope it doesn't become lost as far as them, like, the central goal being figuring out what happened. Is that kind of what...
No, what they meant is the last scene of the last episode, that new person. And I guess they felt it seemed sort of like a hatch in a way.
Right.
You know? So... It didn't feel like that to me at all, because obviously the person knew what they were doing in there. They weren't there just for mysterious, you know, circumstances.
Right. I'm not getting that vibe at all from the show. I'm not concerned about that at all from the show. I do think... I don't know. I guess I'm not seeing a ton of the backlash that you're talking about, Albert, but I don't visit a lot of the side TV blogs and stuff. I think when I'm sitting here trying to think about this initial season, I don't see gigantic gaping plot holes like I do on other television shows sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily agree with it. I'm just something that I've observed, which I think is kind of odd. Just because, I mean, there hasn't been that much. There's only been 5 episodes.
Right, yeah. Yeah, but, I mean, you're talking about the same group of people that wants to judge the entire Spider-Man musical off of one movie show.
Right. So, or the entire Green Lantern movie off of a 30-second clip on Entertainment Tonight.
Right. Not to disparage you, our dear listeners. We love you all. But we're all idiots sometimes.
Speak for yourself, Lucas.
I am. I'm always
extremely intelligent.
We're all idiots sometimes. And and we can get caught up in that stuff. So let's be idiots here for a second, and let's make a snap judgment. I want to hear from both of you. Show versus comic. You can have one or the other. Which one and why? Albert, you first.
Well, I mean, I will say comic just because there's much more to it at this point. I mean, it's kind of hard to judge, I guess.
Well, let's assume the show goes on for 9 seasons.
But, I mean, I think the show's great. And, you know, Andrew Lincoln is awesome as Rick Grimes. I think he's really kind of the heart of the show. And there is also something about, you know, I think maybe just with, like, horror in general and zombies that, like, it's definitely a little bit more visceral when you see it in motion. So I think maybe more than a lot of other comics, The Walking Dead is served well in a live action adaptation.
Right. What do you think, Jill?
It's a tough call. It really is, because
you're not up to date on the comic, right?
I'm not up to date now. I've only read the first couple books. Snap judgment, like you said, I would have to say comic.
Okay.
Just because we only have 6 episodes. I know you're saying to try to imagine, but obviously it's very cool to see it on screen, you know, moving pictures and whatnot. But
them fancy moving pictures.
They have fancy moving pictures. but no, I mean, I think with the comic, I think The Walking Dead was the first comic that kept me on the edge of my seat.
Right.
You know, and that's, you know, I think that's kind of hard to come by, you know, especially with the regular superhero comics. You know, you kind of can predict what's going to happen. But in The Walking Dead, when I read it, I'm always sort of, oh, my God, what's going to happen next? I don't know. You know, and I like that factor. And I guess that can kind of play into the TV show, too. But as it progresses, and as certain characters maybe become fan favorites, there's perhaps the chance that the writer or writers will change what they do, you know, to fit audience reaction.
I hope to hell, and I really think that Frank Darabont is a guy that never would do this. As much as I've disagreed with some of the decisions he's made in the past, I hope to hell that he never makes any decisions on this show based on fan reaction.
He doesn't seem like the type of guy that would.
I don't think that he would.
Has he done a TV series before or just movies?
Just movies, as far as I know.
Yeah. Because it's an entirely different game.
A lot of Stephen King movies. The Mist, which was, like, it was up there to be my favorite movie of all time, and then that last 3 minutes of that movie, like, made me want to cut myself, and I hated it. I hated it. Hated.
Wow. That's what made the movie for me.
That would have been a movie that I would have watched 10,000 times, and because of that last, the ending of that movie, it's totally polarizing, it's completely different from the book, and since then, Stephen King has said he wished he had thought of that, because he would have ended the book that way. So he clearly approves. I do not decry Frank Darabont's genius at all in filmmaking, but I hated it. Hated that ending. digressing again, the comic book is a unique experience, and I'm going to completely cop out here and say screw you to both of you for answering this question, because I'm going to say that this question can't really be answered.
Oh, come on.
And you conceived of the question, so that is kind of annoying.
Right. Seriously. Which is even worse for me to cop out.
The listeners see through you. I'm sorry.
You can't see me. I'm on the radio. the comic book is a unique format. I'm super, super happy that they have deviated from the comic. I'm super, super happy that there are new characters. There's completely new situations. The characters are making slightly different decisions in similar situations. But all of that, to me, is pure genius. And kudos to Kirkman, who's heavily involved in this and is totally cool with that. For a guy that's all about creator-owned and all about creator control of ideas and properties, to give that kind of that level of control over to somebody, I'm certain is difficult for him, but he's doing a great job with it. And ultimately, obviously, yes, if you have to choose one or the other, the comic book, this is a comic for the ages, and it continues to be. It's 80 issues in. It shows no signs of stopping. I could see Kirkman making this a 300-issue book, and I don't know how I would ever be bored, because he changes it so drastically, and he does it at just the right times. Even the most recent trade that just came out, Volume 13 of the book, it was like one gigantic quiet moment with two huge punches in the face, and those meant so much. And in the world of superhero comics being by far the top sellers, there's something refreshing about it, where it's, here's these humans, and they're trying to figure out how to survive. And even 80 issues in, they're trying to figure it out. So I mean, ultimately, it's, you know, the egg came first, and therefore it's definitely the more important beast.
You sure it wasn't the chicken?
I'm 100% positive that the egg came before the chicken. I will I'll concede to my friends over at our sister site, livescience.com. The egg came before the chicken.
Oh, you're bringing science into it. Shut up. Yep. Whatever.
Yep. Yeah, it doesn't belong in this conversation.
This is comic books, damn it.
But for the comic at this point, I mean, Kirkman still doesn't have, like, an endpoint in mind, right?
No, I
it's open-ended.
As far as I've heard, I mean, I think he's actually been quoted as saying that, like, he'd take it 300 issues if he can.
So it does seem very likely that the TV show will end possibly way before the comic book ends. So the TV show will have its own ending, which is interesting.
That is very interesting.
Yeah.
And I have read in interviews Darabont saying that he's planning on talking with Kirkman about an endgame. So
I was going to say, yeah, Kirkman's going to have to be involved in that somehow, because I'm sure he has, you know, at least some inkling of how he would want his own story to end.
Right. Hmm. Well, it'd be interesting to see if he's as tight as somebody like Brian K. Vaughan. For a long time, reportedly, he wrote and had Pia Guerra draw the final panel of the final issue of Why the Last Man after, like, the first arc.
Yeah, so, I remember him always saying he knew how it was going
to
end.
Yeah, and he's like, okay, so this is how it's going to end, and we need to get to this point.
Which, honestly, I say this as a fan. If you're a writer, please do that. Please know where you're going.
Lost.
And he always knew how many issues he wanted to have it, too.
Though. Right, that's true. Ultimately, this is a good TV show. It's a great TV show, even. And I like the new things that it's offering to the general idea of a story called The Walking Dead about a zombie apocalypse and the people that are surviving inside it. So, yeah, I mean, The Walking Dead season finale is this Sunday, and...
I can't believe it's over already.
And then we have to wait, like, 9 or 10 months until...
That sucks!
Until season two.
It's going to be such a long wait.
So that gives everybody a chance to jump into Image's new weekly Walking Dead program and catch up on the book.
Poor little Carl. He's going to age. It's going to become a Walt situation.
That's very true. For those unfamiliar, in the comic, they've aged Carl very, very, very slowly. I think 80 issues, they've gone through about maybe a year and a half or 2 years of story. So Carl is not much older than he is right now.
And that little kid that's playing him is, like, on the verge.
Was already cast older.
Yeah.
Than Carl was in the comic, I think.
Well, he's on the verge of a growth spurt anyway, so...
He's on the verge of being recasted, perhaps. I hate to be the one to break it to that little boy.
You go tell him.
That's all we have for you today on Newsarama Radio. Stay tuned, because next week we have our first guest.
What?
Ooh.
Who's it going to be? Tune in, and you'll find out. Before we go... For that lucky listener that listened in this entire time.
Did you say that as if there was only one?
I may have phrased that the wrong way.
For those.
For the first lucky listener who listened to this all the way through, listened all the way to the end, and has an Xbox 360 and Halo Reach, guess what? If you're quick on your feet right now, you are going to get the Noble Map Pack for free. All you have to do is go to your Xbox Live account and put in the following code, exactly as I say it, CC6VPTJP2WFRW9FDHDP694.
Is that the longest code I've ever heard in my life?
X7Z.
Sorry.
Take out the longest code you've ever heard in your life thing. Don't type that in. Drop us a comment down below here on BlogAt and let us know that you have won so that we can all congratulate you.
I guess we're not eligible, right?
We are not eligible.
Damn.
Jill, put your phone down. Get off Xbox Live.
But
that's it. I'm Lucas.
I already put the code in, though.
So. Well, you all lost, including Albert. I'm Lucas.
I'm Jill.
I'm Albert.
And this is Newsarama Radio. Thanks for listening. Bye! Because the geek shall inherit the earth. Get your geek on, baby, for what it's worth. The first shall be last, and the last shall be first. Check the base, cosine, inverse. Because the geek shall inherit the earth. I never knew the brain could be so sexy.